Welcome to the Bibliopod for the week of May 29th. I'm Ann Kingston.
I'm Brian Bethune.
In today's episode, we'll tackle the thorny topic of cronyism in book reviewing. Brian will talk to Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges about his new book of essays, Wages of Rebellion. And we'll chat about the imperiled state of modern poetry with Scott Griffin, the founder of the Griffin Poetry Prize, which celebrates its 15th anniversary this year. So, Brian, the subject of literary cronyism, more specifically what constitutes conflict of interest in book reviewing, has bubbled up as a hot topic over the past few weeks. New York Times public editor Margaret Sullivan wrote a column that addressed a number of criticisms that have been levied against the paper's book review section by readers. These included reviewers being too close to the authors of the book they were reviewing. Martin Amis was criticized for reviewing Saul Bellow, someone he considers as his father figure, or reviewers were seen to have built-in biases against the subject matter they were reviewing. Natalie Andrier, who's a Times science writer, reviewed a book about psychiatry, in which she admitted she had a horrible personal experience with psychoanalysis. And we've seen this fascinating back and forth, which I would love to have your thoughts about, in the Globe and Mail and the National Post in the last week. In the Globe, Toronto author Pasha Mala talked about literary cronyism before giving an incredibly glowing review to a good friend's book. That was countered in the National Post by a critical look at what Pasha Mala did in the Globe
review. While praising the book.
And Emily Keeler, who reviewed the book in the National Post, admitted she too was friends with the author of this book under discussion. Giving Up is a novel, first novel written by Mike Steves. So we have this back and forth going on, and it raises a lot of interesting questions right. About what is a book review. We've reached a point where friends are allowed to review friends' books in papers. I mean, where are the lines and how do we draw them?
Well, I appreciate they were all in Wonderland by the time they got to the end, but taken together, this is an ongoing narrative about book reviewing, not about the book. At this point, it's all about who's close enough, who's too close. And no, we have not yet got to the point where friends should be doing friends' reviews, no matter what they think of them.
Yet, the New York Times column talked to the book review's editor, who said they don't necessarily disqualify a book reviewer simply because they reveal that they know the person. It's very hard within these small literary communities
not to know. And quite right. You should put your trust in the publication. I know that the editors want some kind of conversation. They want more than, here's someone who knows nothing at all about this book and will give you an honest opinion of whether it's good. Maybe that doesn't work. You want something going on in the pages, some sort of talking back and forth.
But let's go back to the Pasha Mala example, because he sort of sets this up as talking about all of the lines that are drawn and what reviewers should be, you know, rules for reviewers and for sitting on literary prizes in terms of, you know, do you know the writer? Where are your conflicts of interest? Now, what was interesting in this case is he laid them all out on the table. But one of the conflicts that he reveals in this in the column, the review, was that he, in fact, had contributed. He had read the manuscript, that he had offered suggestions. He even blurbed the back of the book, offered promotional material for it. So I would suggest that at that point, the whole exercise should explode.
Yes.
Because you cannot possibly contribute to the creation of a book and review it.
And for him to, well, I've got all this, all these problems, but that's okay because I've told you about them, is belied by the rest of his experience. He's tossed off the Governor General's jury because of his connection to this book. They don't say to him, well, it's fine now that you've told us all your connections. Now you can sit and judge it.
But what
the error here is the Globes in running this thing.
Well, the other interesting aspect. I want to talk a bit more about what novels get noticed and why and who gets left behind. Often really good stuff gets left behind. But what was funny is that it speaks to a larger, I think, point of where we are culturally, because one of the things that Mala said at the end was, if you don't believe me, Miriam Taves thinks so too, having declared its author, meaning Steves, a brilliant singular voice in canlit. And she doesn't know Mike at all. And she's from Manitoba, which is a great non sequitur, however. But the point here is that it's great that that's her opinion of the book. She obviously likes it. But, you know, it's almost as if that gives great authority to what's being said. Whatever happened to textual criticism?
Yes, we're now blurbing the blurbs.
Exactly.
And, why didn't they have Taves review it? Well, maybe she's busy.
Maybe she was busy helping her friends.
But I mean, when you get down honest, the New York issue seemed to be meatier to me because it crossed over into the nonfiction and worried about enemy reviews, about people who are
ideologically
really
opposed to the
subject. And I find those like easier to police. If people who you know are opposed to things and they tell you about it, and then they grant every good point of the other one while still wielding a stiletto, well, then I'm inclined to trust that they're being fair with the subject. Whereas I find that really hard to tell the other way. Somebody said, well, he's my best friend and all that, but when I warmly praise what he's writing, I mean it.
I don't find that hard to
distrust
at all. I just don't. I choose not to.
Well, I don't trust that at all, but it's so hard to tell when you're trying to be fair to what's being written.
But it's interesting because, for instance, you can take that to extremes because you saw Maureen Dowd reviewing the Hillary Clinton book, which became just sort of a...
You would read that for pure entertainment, not for any knowledge
exactly,
of the book.
Which is one of the reasons, you know, reviews do exist. It's not only to provide fiber and spinach. I mean, it's also to hopefully entertain the audience.
Yes.
A book review has failed if it doesn't also do that.
Right.
There's a piece that you and I both have read in The Telegraph in March that talked about, it had a great title, Why Great Novels Don't Get Noticed Now, which basically sums it up. And the point was that there are so many restrictions on who gets noticed and why they get noticed. And the serious novel often gets short shrifted, although if you look at book prizes, you don't see that happening. But there's sort of this place in fiction, in what's known as the middle of the list within publishing, where you have somebody, not a new writer, maybe somebody a bit older, who's produced something really remarkable. And I think of K.D. Miller and her book, All Saints, which was published last year, and remarkable book that just sort of fell, you know, fortunately across our radar at Maclean's. We reviewed it. But otherwise, it's just such a crapshoot, isn't it?
It is. It's completely. And things have to be slotted into some sort of space. I mean, all book review editors know far more pours in than you can deal with. And you're judging sometimes on superficialities. You cannot invest the time to find out whether you should invest more time.
So it's almost as if a story or a novel or even nonfiction has to have its own story.
Right, which may explain why, you know, plots are getting more extreme all the time. Something has to.
To take you into another dimension so that it's tweetable or something that creates another form of buzz that will cause it to be noticed that has nothing to do necessarily with merit. The Telegraph piece was heralding the novel Dear Thief by Samantha Harvey.
And it supposedly had everything going for it, right?
That's it. It was big publisher, great reviews, and it got lost in the fray because there's so much noise. That's the problem. You know, you've got Goodreads, you've got all sorts of blogs, you've got everything out there, but there's so much noise, it almost makes it even tougher for something that doesn't have all of the bells and whistles attached to get noticed. So, should friends review friends?
Never. But enemies and enemies, yes.
Because it's interesting.
Because I would never read Hillary Clinton's memoirs, but I would certainly read Maureen Dowd's review of them.
The Griffin Poetry Prize, Canada's most generous literary award, with a total of 200,000 given out at an annual gala, celebrates its 15th anniversary on June 4th. Today, its founder, Scott Griffin, this businessman, publisher, and philanthropist who provides the cash, joins us in the Bibliopod to talk about a genre both culturally significant and economically marginalized.
Thanks for coming by.
You're welcome.
Was that, I suppose, though I could be wrong, the main impetus for you to finding the prize, the economic troubles of poetry?
Well, I think it's fair to say that poetry has slipped from the mainstream of our cultural lives. And I felt that poetry is very important. It's, in fact, the mirror of our soul, if you like. It represents the beauty of language. And it was important to try and get it back on the map.
Right. Well, when you look back, it's not a matter, it seems to me, of poetry slipping down a kind of popular hierarchy as novels sweeping all before them. In the mid-20th century, there were still significant poets that people knew by name in a large sense, just as there were playwrights. And now...
Well, part of the problem was that poetry disappeared from our schools.
Yes.
It became very fashionable to disregard or eliminate the idea of rote memory. And one of the best ways to get close to poetry, short of having written it, is to memorize it. When this went out of fashion, teachers were robbed, if you like, of the tools for teaching poetry, and it basically with few exceptions, disappeared out of the schools. So then you had a generation growing up that were not familiar with poetry, and that's how I think it really did slip away from our cultural lives.
Well, what was the poetry of your childhood? The what set the hooks in you to make you a poetry lover?
Well, my father used to read it to us after dinner. That was a big part of our growing up. And then I was very keen to try to prove to him that I could find some poetry. His poetry basically stopped with Eliot and Pound.
Right.
And I went on with E.E. Cummings and Ferlinghetti and others like
right.
that to show him that, yes, there are other worlds, and I'm right. very keen on discovering them.
Now, in addition to the Griffin Prize, you have also initiated a program within the Canadian school systems to make poetry resonate with a new generation.
We formed a second prize for students who have to get up and memorize poems and deliver these with just a microphone on the stage in front of an audience and judges. This does two things. One, it introduces the beauty of language. And secondly, it gives them a great sense of confidence.
It's almost as if you're offering a gateway into poetry. But I'm wondering, in an age when expression is shorter, it's more intense, it's more specific, you would think that poetry would have a new
resonance.
In that moment. Is it how we're framing poetry? Because poetry is not simply what we think of as the Tennyson students once had to memorize right. in the classroom.
Well, poetry has always been best when it's been oral. Whether it has a specific role in this technological age, I think it's more universal than that. If you think about it, with very few words, you can cover the full range of human experience, and that's why poetry is so difficult to write well.
Also difficult in the sense that it requires a lot of attention to fully appreciate its meaning. Over the past 15 years, what have you yourself learned about poetry, or how has your depth of understanding changed?
Well, that's a big question, of course, but I've, first of all, extended the range of my knowledge of poetry through just the number of poets we've had. If you think about it, we have seven shortlisted each year who come to read, four international and three Canadian. And over 15 years, that's a lot of different poetry.
Yes.
The winner of the English this year came from Newfoundland in one of the outports.
Well, thank you very much for coming by. Appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
And on June 3rd, people can tune in to watch the live streaming of the shortlisted authors reading their works at Kerner Hall in Toronto on the Griffin Prize website.
Chris Hedges pushes the term outlier to its full extent. A former Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for the New York Times, a Presbyterian minister, a fierce critic of the corporate state and of the U.S. mania for mass incarceration, Hedges is also the author of best-selling books issued by major publishers. I spoke to him recently about the topics covered in his latest, Wages of Rebellion, including the way Herman Melville's mighty novel, Moby Dick, carries within it America's cultural DNA.
All right, so the first thing I wanted to ask, your book is a book about disaster, not just the state of things now, but how they're going to get worse, and how people in opposition, you in fact, are going to get crushed by it. But I'm still uncertain whether to call this a despairing or a hopeful book.
Well, you know, I'm just actually in the third volume, almost done with Gulag Archipelago, which is a remarkable, it's a masterpiece, I've not read it. But there you have, especially in the last volume, all these camp uprisings, which are crushed.
Right.
And yet, I think Solzhenitsyn would agree that these are examples of the highest of the human spirit, especially since they know what they're up against. And that you can't use the word hope if you don't resist, and that finally resistance in the face of overwhelming power or rebellion is not defined so much by what you achieve, but by what you become. And that's the thesis of the book. It's about having the courage to stand up for what's right. In the last paragraph, write that I don't fight fascists because I'm going to win. I fight fascists because they're fascists. And you're sustained by faith, not kind of any orthodox religious faith, but the faith that the good draws to it the good. The Buddhists call it karma. We don't know where it goes. While all the empirical evidence around us may point otherwise, that what we've done is futile and useless, it's the faith that it wasn't.
Did you find writing the book what I found reading it? But almost every day in the news, there'd be some sort of ironic commentary or confirmation of it. I mean, you would read about the way water rationing is playing out so differently for the poor and the rich in California. And it seems like
the poor don't have water and the rich do.
Yeah, and they keep these price signals that we're supposed to take care of everything, and they have too much money.
You know, it's not a critique that brings me any joy. I fear societal breakdown. I've been in the midst of societal, but I don't want this to happen. I would like a system by which we could carry out reform. We had institutions that could carry out reform. I would like an open electoral system. We just don't have it. I would like a press that would give voice to all sorts of viewpoints and critiques. We don't have it.
Yeah.
I would like a system where we are not under wholesale surveillance. We don't have it. I would like a system where militarized police forces are not able to gun down poor people of color with impunity and walk away from it. We don't have it.
Well, that was one of the more extraordinary things that I kept thinking about while reading, is every one of these big city police forces has agents of the federal government, like the major crushers of constitutional liberties in the United States, come down to make sure that no one's constitutional rights are being broken in Baltimore or Ferguson or wherever.
And the repression, well, not only did they deploy National Guard troops in Baltimore, and people forget that under Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act, those troops have the legal authority to arrest, seize American citizens and detain them and strip them of due process.
Yeah.
In Baltimore, they roll tanks into the streets against an unarmed population. I mean, it was a military occupation of an American city with heavy weapons. And there was no violence. Now, wait, we have seen in the last week, roughly, a New York City police officer shot dead and two police officers shot dead in Mississippi. Now, if I'm just praying or hoping against hope that these are just isolated incidents and not a pattern. But if that becomes a pattern, then the counter acts of terrorism by the state will become much more pronounced and much more violent.
But for all the denial people come up with, I do not see how anyone can argue with you over the fact the United States doesn't seem any longer to be a liberal democracy.
I don't think there's much. I mean, you have powerful systems of propaganda that are beholden to corporate power that want to perpetuate that myth and have a vested interest in perpetuating the myth. But in fact, I don't think very many Americans are buying it, and it doesn't matter whether they're right-wing or left-wing or in the middle. I think, you see it. Like, Congress's approval rating is 7%.
Right. It's not just the gutting of the constitutional protections and Obama getting up and saying, nobody really cares what you're saying. We just have to gather this all up for security. It's the carceral state.
Yeah.
You talk about there's 7 million people under some kind of...
Yeah, under some kind of...
In jail or
right,
or
so either they're convicted felons or they're on parole. I mean, we have 25% of the world's prison population. Of course, this is what happens with redundant or surplus labor. These bodies don't generate revenues on the street. They generate $40,000 or $50,000 if they're locked in a cage. And corporate forces have been working quite diligently to exploit that population.
Right.
So they've privatized commissaries, they've privatized phones, extracting exorbitant fees from the poorest of the poor. Prisoners are not issued their most basic items, including shoes. You have huge numbers of corporations that are now working inside the prison system, using labor that earns, you know, 20 cents an hour.
Yeah, the vicious circle of the thing. It's only weak point is that it costs a lot of money to run. But if you get
people going in saying,
"Well, I'm going to turn a profit out of this."
Right, but the corporations don't run it, so it's parasitic off the state.
Right.
So they, in the same way that Halliburton is, you know, Halliburton is all taxpayer money, although they run all their subsidiaries out of Dubai so they don't have to pay taxes.
Correct.
And, you know, I teach in a prison, and it's so many of those cases, you know, 94% of those cases never go to trial.
Yeah.
It's all plea bargaining. There's no hope for them. There's no justice. The primary mechanism they use to convict are informants,
right,
who are cut deals with police in order to mitigate or even.
Right.
So, I mean, it's a completely insane system.
Yeah, and the other method is, I don't know why anyone accepts that a guilty plea means that someone is actually guilty.
Right.
I mean, you pile on the charges until pretty much have to take a plea bargain.
Yeah, they pile on like 18 charges and they'll offer to take off 10, but you're still going away for 20, 30 years.
Yeah.
That's how they do it. But the other really nasty aspect of the system is that if you do go to trial, they'll convict you on all the charges as an example. Because since 94% plea out, if everybody went to trial, the system would collapse. In the same way that if prisoners were ever paid minimum wage, the prison system would collapse because the engine of mass incarceration is neo-slavery.
And you wrote very interestingly about the power of imagination and how key this is to making this a revolutionary moment. I want to talk about Moby Dick, too, like the genome of the American people.
Right. It's kind of the most important novel in American literature. I think it most succinctly captures the American character. The character of capitalist exploitation and imperialism. It's kind of brilliant. I mean, it's why, you know, it didn't sell in Melville's lifetime. Melville knew how subversive a book it was. We know from Letters to Hawthorne that he knew very well what he was doing.
And he couldn't have, it's a moment too, right? It's the 1850s, I guess it comes?
1853 or something, I think.
When you can see the Civil War looming. But all these other details, 30 crew, 30 states.
Right. The named after an extinct Indian tribe. Named the Pequot instead of the Pequot, yeah.
Yeah, and the white guys in charge and the hard labor from the colored guys.
Exactly. All the dirty work is done by the wretched of the earth.
Many of whom are noble savages.
Yeah.
Many whom are not, but I mean, it's just and Starbuck, who was supposed to be, well, it's good enough to chain her, name a chain after.
Right.
And the other interesting issue, I guess, is the lack of language. Just speaking from a progressive side, it is so hard to find a language to explain.
Yeah, right, because
we've corporatized our brains.
Right, we have. I mean, it's like when, you know, publicists start talking to me about my brand, you know, I run for the door. I'm not a brand, I'm not a commodity, platforming. You find it just an utter infection of concepts and language into every aspect of our life.
Right.
And language is important. It's very important. And we have to begin to speak in a language that we're not given, but that expresses our reality and where we want to go. And we're not there yet. So we are in what Gramsci called this interregnum, or what Berkman calls, you know, the invisible revolution, where the old ideas are discredited, but we have not articulated yet.
We have no language yet.
Yeah, we don't have a language yet.
That was Chris Hedges speaking to me last week.
You've been listening to The Bibliopod. Please join us next time. The Bibliopod is produced by Sarmishta Subramanian, the music by Stephen Scratt and Asher Lenz, additional music by Simon Gadke. Thanks to Scott Metcalf for technical assistance.